I'm Levy Dalton.
And I'm Erin Scala.
And this is I'll Drink to That, a weekly behind-the-scenes look at the wine business.
I'm Molly from Public Restaurant, and I use 750 all the time. It has all of the information I could possibly need. It makes my life so much easier, and it's one of the best reference tools I have. I love 750.com.
Peter Weigand of Weigand Selections on the show today. Hello, sir. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you.
Nice to see you.
It's very nice to be here.
So you were studying to be a lawyer.
I was back in the early 70s. It was when I started law school. And about that same time, I got interested in wine.
And how did that come about?
Well, just really tasting with family. My older sister, older brother had started to enjoy wine because in our family, we didn't have wine when I was growing up. It's not something that we, did as a, I didn't grow up in a wine-making family or in the wine business at all.
Was it exotic to you for that reason? You were kind of like, hey, what is this?
I think there was a little bit of that, but also it just really tasted good. It was another sort of experiential level.
And so you're there kind of preparing for torts and case law class, and you're like, hey, what about Bordeaux?
Yeah, my mind actually did wander once in a while, thinking about the next tasting, because I organized a little tasting group when I was in law school, and read a lot about it, really got interested in it.
What was the next progression for you along your route into wine?
My second year of law school was at NYU, and there I really got sort of immersed in the whole New York culture and buying wine and learning about wine and on a firsthand level, because in those days it seemed expensive to me at the time, but I could buy 1970 second growth Bordeaux for about $5 a bottle and first growth Bordeaux for about $12-$13 a bottle. I remember still my wife sitting there on the steps outside of a wine shop debating whether we should buy that bottle of 1970 Latour for $13.65 or not. I finally persuaded her. Yeah, it was a good idea.
Kind of like Apple stock back in the day.
Yeah, well, I didn't do that, though, unfortunately.
So you were organizing buying trips, and then you also moved from the Midwest to the East Coast. You're in New York, then Pennsylvania.
Yeah. 1981, we moved to Pennsylvania and continued on, buying, enjoying, collecting, learning from retailers. Because in those days, we didn't have all of the experts and all the writers that we have now. So one source was really pretty much your retailer. A few, the English, like Harry Waugh, Michael Broadbent. I read, of course, Frank Schoonmaker's Encyclopedia, Alexis Lachine. But there were no like periodicals like we have in the last 20 years, 25 years.
One of those retailers sort of connected you with a trip to Burgundy.
Yeah. In 1985, my wife and I took like our first vacation in like 10 years. My parents agreed to take kids so we could get away. And we went to France for about a week. I can't remember the exact length. But a retailer in Maryland, Rick Ostrand was his name at State Line, let me kind of tag along with him. He was going with importer, distributor friends, arranged appointments for him. And he was nice enough and they were generous enough to let me tag along with him.
What were some of those visits?
The ones that stand out were Ponceau, Clos de l'Ombre, Montjard Muneret, Le Fleuve, Metro. I think they actually even got me into, we even actually went to Romane Conti. Yeah. I don't know why it took me so long to remember that one.
And you import Clos de l'Ombre today, so that's almost kind of like a full circle.
Yeah, it was. I thought about that on my first professional visit to L'Ombre. It was just about exactly 10 years to the date after my first visit there with Rick.
So you taste a lot of wine. You're there in 85, so that's a year that was quite good, but it was still being harvested at that time, so you're probably tasting 83s and 84s.
tasting mostly 83s. Yeah.
And then maybe they pull out some older vintages for you now and again.
Yeah, at the end of every tasting, there was a very generous opening of, you know, like library selections. And, you know, you don't go and spit 1969, you know, Grand Cru. You know. So after a long day of tasting and not always spitting, it was a long day. I wouldn't say I was so much cognitively affected as I had never tasted wines like that before. You know, a whole day of tasting 7, 8, 10 wines at one place, then having a little sip, then going on to the next place and doing the same thing. And, you know, like you got over 100, you know, and the most I'd probably ever done was 10. And so I got really like palate fatigue. And that was a new experience for us. And so anyway, came time for dinner. And as we were driving up and down the Route Nationale 74, that day we saw a little sign for an auberge up in the Haute Côte. it was called the Ferme du Roll. And we thought that would be nice, just to go up and be a nice little peaceful place for dinner. So that's what we did. Yeah, so it's all kind of coming back. So we're there. It was a nice place. They have this kind of a big open fireplace. And their specialty was to grill stuff on the fire. And, you know, particularly fresh hams, they'd grill that. And I remember that's what we got. And we... We got to the time you would order, and we just agreed that we couldn't order another glass of wine after that whole day of wine. So we ordered a beer, and it was kind of a brasserie type arrangement. So it was long tables and then chairs on each side, and the sort of next table next to us, or the family next to us, was obviously French, and it was a husband and wife and their two young children. And so it was about halfway through the meal. They could tell that I couldn't speak any French because my wife was doing all the talking with the servers. But about halfway through the meal, the gentleman turned to my wife, or got my wife's attention, and said to her in French, you know, excuse us, but we can't help but make an observation that here you are in Burgundy, and there are wines here in Burgundy. And we're just curious why you're at this restaurant and you're not drinking any wine, or you're drinking beer. And so she explained to him both the joys and of the day, but also the predicament we were in. And he said, well, you know, if you'd like to taste Burgundies that don't fatigue your palate, or maybe not, you're welcome to come visit us tomorrow morning if you'd like. And so we did. That was a Saturday night. I remember that because I was really quite surprised that someone would receive us on a Sunday morning. But it was 11 o'clock. They asked us to come over at 11 o'clock Sunday morning. And we did. And it was really fun because, you know, not only were the wines superb, but it was like our first time on our own. You know, we weren't with people in the trade. It was a very different sort of dynamic. And they were lovely people, and it was just a really good time. And the wines left an indelible impression.
What was the name of that producer?
That was Jackie Truchot and his wife Lillian, and their two children, Alexander and Valerie, were with them. And that time they were very young. Now they're fully grown, have children of their own, so forth.
And it was called Truchot Martin back then.
Yeah, yeah. The name, for example, Monjard Muniray, is another example. In Europe, quite often the husband's wife, the husband's name is hyphenated with the wife's maiden name. So it was Jackie Truchot, and Lillian's maiden name was Martin. Her family was actually Georges Martin, who was the main sort of equipment supplier. in the Côte d'Inuit at that time. He had a display, or his office or his facility was located right across the Route Nationale from Maurice Saint-Denis.
You ended up calling your own company a hyphenated name, Wygant Metzler.
Well, we didn't know what to call it. We decided after visiting them that, you know, after a few months thinking about it, we thought I would like to try to import a little wine, and particularly their wine. And so in the process of coming up with a name, we thought that would be kind of nice, you know, to kind of imitate the European fashion of doing so. So my wife's maiden name was Metzler. So it wasn't really going to be a commercial venture. So we thought, well, there's no really terrible harm in naming a company something that nobody can pronounce. So we just did it.
And what was the first vintage of the Truchot wines that you brought in?
The first vintage was the 1984. We started with them, I think it was the end of 86, beginning of 87. And, you know, so the 85s were just going to be bottled, and the 84s were a very challenging vintage. People might remember, very, very light in color. And it was difficult, but Jackie's Wines, even in 84, had his unmistakable imprint of fruit and spice and character. And it was difficult, certainly, because of the light color and also because the wines were completely unknown. But I think I might still have one bottle left, just as a memory.
Because he had taken over in the late 70s after Jackie came back from the Algerian War. So it had actually been called something else earlier.
Yeah. Jackie, back before the war in Algeria, started with his cousin to work for his cousin. Jackie grew up on a farm and worked for his cousin, Henri Moffray. And then he was drafted into the war in Algeria. And after that, he came back and worked with the Moffrays. And later met Lillian, and they were married. And in 1978, Monsieur Moffray died. And I don't know for a fact whether they had agreed before or after his death to sell the estate, like on an installment kind of basis, to Jackie and Lillian, because the Moffrays had no children.
So it wasn't that well known, and it also was under a new name. It was fairly new at that time, because you're bringing in the 84s, and he kind of took over in 79. So,
Jackie had never commercialized. He had just been selling to Negos and just bottles to private customers. He hadn't done any export at that point.
And he's mostly famous for Maurice Saint-Denis, but he made other communes as well.
Yeah, but certainly Maurice Saint-Denis. His bench, if we benchmark or flagship wine was the Clos Orbais, because Moffray and then he owned the better part of the Premier Cru Clos Orbais. He also had vineyards in Gevrey, Chambertin, Village, and Gevrey Premier Cru Combat, and Chambertin, and then also a small parcel in Chambol-Musigny, Chambol Premier Cru Sentier. But most of his vineyards were in Maurice Saint-Denis.
And it was actually the Clos Orbais that he held on to the longest after he sold some of the other parcels.
No, he sold, I believe, all of the main part of the estate altogether. Just kept a tiny parcel of Les Orbais, not the Clos, but Les Orbais, which is just behind a wall from the Clos, a few percent of a hectare, a few R.
Got it. And you had mentioned light color. That's something I sort of associated with Truchot throughout his career in many different vintages. Was that ever a challenge in the market?
It was always a challenge at the beginning. It wasn't until later that, particularly when David Schuchnack started writing about his wines, that I think people really understood that color wasn't that important. Many journalists said that color is not important in Burgundy, but ironically, the wines that they scored the highest were the ones with the most color. And what I think two people started to learn with experience in with Jackie's wines was that even though they were light in color early on, they didn't lose any color like most Burgundies do. And after 10, 12 years, his wines were the same color as everybody else's, pretty much.
But he's often thought of today as someone who produced somewhat of a unique style. He never went to an enology school. He sort of had his own methods. How would you talk about those methods, and was it a unique style?
Well, I harvested there every year. I missed 2003 because it was so early that I didn't get my plane ticket in time. But 1, 2, 4, 5. And I don't pretend at all to understand Jackie's secrets, because they really, because no one can quite do what he did. But I know that he destemmed, and I know that he did not believe in extracting tannins. Didn't feel that tannin had much to do with great Burgundy, or at least the Burgundies that he liked. And he always told me that he makes wines that he likes. If people like them, that's great. If they don't, it's okay. But he's making them because he likes wines like the way he makes them. So there was no long pre-fermentation maceration. There was no elevation of fermentation temperatures. So it was fairly, I think, a fairly cool fermentation. But I honestly did not spend time, you know, in the cellar after harvest with him. So what I'm saying is probably somewhat speculation, but it's what I know.
Sometimes when people talk about Truchot, they say that in an era where low yields was being very lauded in the press, he was keeping his yields a little higher. Is that something that you also observed?
Yeah, I think Jackie, it's no exaggeration that Jackie made the rendement. You know, he was allowed to do 50 hectoliter for the village. He did 50 hectoliter. I don't think he really believed that you had to have draconian yields to make the wines in the style that he wanted. Now, certainly in vintages like 03, 05, 01, you know, where there was less yield, he made less, but, I don't ever remember anything, you know, him talking about things in the teens or 20s, you know.
And you worked with the wines for 30 years in the market, give or take. And was it somewhat odd to see the change after he retired in terms of the fame of the wines?
Well, yes, it was. Particularly in comparing after 2005 with the late 80s and the early 90s, when it was so difficult to, you know, convince people of the merits of these beautiful wines. But it's like everything, I think, with human nature, that you can't get something anymore. All of a sudden, something that one has to have.
How would you sum up the different wines that he did make? I mean, I know he made a Pasta Grand, and he made a little Grand Cru, and as you said, the Sorbet. If you were to talk about some of the differences between the range of wines that he made, were there things that stood out for you that perhaps weren't what you'd normally think of as the generalization from that particular commune or vineyard?
All of them were very different to me. They each had their own character. They each had their own terroir. It's true that they were different from other people's. For example, his Clos La Roche was quite different from Ponceau's Clos La Roche. But within his style, each one was very expressive. I mean, you know, we always play around when I would come to blind taste and guess which wine it was. And, after a while, I got pretty good at it, you know, because it wasn't that hard because the wines were so expressive.
Somebody else I think of in your portfolio has had a really expressive style was Vatan, which is another small grower that you worked with in the Loire Valley. How did you end up discovering Vuitton?
Well, I was on another trip a few years later, actually with Rick again. He came with me this time. We were in a restaurant in Sancerre, and very nice sommelier there. His name was Didier Turpin. And a few years after that, he opened his own restaurant in Sancerre called the Pomme d'Or, which is a really nice place. We had struck up a conversation and learned, you know, that we were in the trade. And so the first thing that any French sommelier is going to do to any American in the trade is to give him a glass of wine and tell him to try to guess it, you know, blind. And so he did that, and we guessed that it was Cota, and he said, yeah, you're right. So we started talking a little bit about Cota's wines, and he said, well, there are only two producers left in Sancerre who make wines like this, the Cota brothers and Edmond Vatin. But Edmond Vatin is so small, he makes the Cota brothers look like a big enterprise. And he said, he can't get the wines. But I was really curious, so I looked up his number in the phone book and called him the next morning, and he said it'd be okay for me to come over. So we did, and I tasted them, and it was an experience kind of similar to that first time I tasted Jackie's wines. It was, tasting a wine unlike any other Sancerre and any other white wine I'd ever had. So that was really nice, and at least he let me buy some. So that was the beginning. I worked with him from 1989, until a couple of years ago when he could no longer do it and has turned it over to his daughter, Anne. He just kind of helps, consults and helps her, gives her advice, but she's doing all the winemaking now.
And what was it that he was doing, do you think? Oftentimes I hear traditional method, but what did that mean for Vuitton?
Well, that first visit, we tasted out of both barrels and tank. And he was alternating between vinification in one and then racking into the other, and vice versa. And I don't think I have any photographs of them, but the barrels left a lasting impression. It was in this tiny, tiny cubicle of a cellar, and these barrels were white with mold. They were 100-year-old Martinique rum barrels. And the ones that were empty, there was a sulfur wick hanging in them. And that was the extent of his hygiene. So it was pretty neat tasting out of those barrels. But then after several years, I can't remember when the barrels disappeared, and it was all from that point on. It was all done in old enameled steel, not stainless steel, but enameled. Those probably dated back to the maybe 40s.
And he had parcels in Le Mondam.
His Sauvignon was all in the Mont d'Amnay. Actually, the name Clos La Neor is a parcel pretty much in the center of the Mont d'Amnay. And then his Pinot Noir were on the facing slope, northeast facing slope. Slightly different terroir and certainly a different exposition.
Because I've only seen the Pinot Noir once. I had the 03 one time. Did he produce it every year, or was it quite small in production?
2003, to my understanding, was his last vintage. He sold those parcels after that vintage. And he sold some of the Sauvignon also about that time, I believe. Because now it's only 1 hectare.
How do you recall the Pinot Noir that he made?
Well, it was a little bit like Jackie's. Certainly no pre-fermentation, maceration, and the fermentation temperature was whatever nature was that year. If it was a cool harvest, it was a cool fermentation. If it was a hot, if it was hot that September, October, it was a warm fermentation. But he did not destem. It was all traditional whole cluster fermentation.
How did you find the white wines to age?
They are extraordinary. I mean, I've kept the first vintage, the 88, and it's still fine. I've had 83. I have a little 83, one or two bottles of 83. And I've had some older vintages with Monsieur Vatton. And they're just absolutely extraordinary, remarkable. They're not like any other dry wine that I can think of, except perhaps maybe the old Romanes when Pierre was making them.
And another producer back in Burgundy that you brought in was Chermet in Beaujolais. How did you end up finding Chermet?
This was back in early 1992, I believe. And if I'm correct, we found a brochure somewhere in Paris. It might have even been the airport or something, or maybe I got it in the U.S. and brought it with me. But it was in those days, there were no trade shows. There were no French publications on wine like Revue de Vin de France. So there really wasn't much way that producers made it known, other than sort of the best restaurants and the most knowledgeable sommelier knew who the best were. But for a young producer or a producer from a less well-known appellation, it was hard. And so, you know, they would put, you know, information about themselves in whatever little publications, you know, would come along, I guess. I don't know. But I read it. We read about them, and we had heard also that Willie's Wine Bar in Paris, which at that time was still new, or not, you know, hadn't been around a long time, carried those wines as well. And we went to visit them and really, really liked them. Just a beautiful style of Beaujolais. And that became really one of the cornerstones of our portfolio, that style of natural Beaujolais, in fact, natural wines.
Would you think of someone like Vatton or Truchot as a natural producer?
Yeah, I would. All of our producers, I've always looked to find people who did things naturally. And I grant you that that's a vague word. Not necessarily organic or biodynamic, but for me, the most important thing about great wine is the grape growing process. And you can just tell when you start talking to the right kind of person, the right-minded kind of person, that what they're doing in the vineyard, and it's always the same. And whether it's organic or biodynamic or sustainable, it's the work by the grower with their hands in the vineyard being, you know, personally involved. And a great example of that for me is Laurent Charvin in Châteauneuf-du-Pape. I don't think Laurent is necessarily organic, but there isn't a more natural grower probably in my portfolio than he. Because he just, you know, he really walks the walk. I mean, he is in the vines all the time, working the vines, you know, tilling them by hand and you know, getting involved with, you know, the culture of each vine. And that's where it's done. That enables the grower to harvest that that magical, almost impossible to describe balance between complete ripeness, physiological ripeness, but not at the expense of acidity and freshness in the grape. And that's the secret of great wine.
How were you introduced to Charvin?
Well, again, we were reading anything we could get our hands on. And I think one of them was we looked actually at the results of the Concours General of the Concours Agricole in Paris. You know, every year they would give a gold medal and a silver medal and a bronze medal to a Chateauneuf and to a Cote Rôtie and to a, so on down the line. And the one for Chateauneuf du Pape, was the gold went to Charvin, and the silver went to one that I'd heard of. I knew they were good, and the bronze went to one that I knew they were good. So I figured, well, this guy that got the gold, he must be okay too. So we found him, went to visit him. It was, I think, January of 92. And it was the 1990. And we met him, and it turns out that was the first wine he ever made. He had just finished viticulture school at Beaune, in 1990, and joined his father. And the 1990 harvest was the first one he made. And he got the gold medal in Paris, and Mr. Parker tasted it, and I think he gave it like 90, I can't remember, it was 92 or 94 points or something like that.
Because sometimes I feel when producers have a lot of Grenache in a wine, the alcohol and the blousiness can sort of be noticeable, but I never had that sensation with Charvin, and I wonder why that might be in your thought.
Well, again, the word is balance, and that's a nebulous word. You know, it's difficult to talk about it. But a wine that is high in alcohol can be balanced. A wine that's low in alcohol can be out of balance. A wine that's 12.5% alcohol can be hot on the palate, and a wine that's 14.5-15% can taste fresh on the palate. And the reason is because the wine is balanced. I know I admit that's a little bit like putting the rabbit in the hat, but when you taste, you see what's going on. And for me, particular heat on a wine is something that's sticks out. And that, as you said, Charvin's wines have just extraordinary balance. And even though they're 15%, you know, most in particularly these last years, like 07 and 09 and 10, there's never a sensation of heat on the finish.
And has that been an issue more in the Rhone? Because I feel like the Rhone has been an area you've explored to some degree with more and more rising temperatures.
Yeah, the rising temperatures, but also I think there's a trend in the winemaking to get even more ripeness, perhaps even like over-ripeness, sear maturity, and then extra extraction. You know, those wines certainly are valid and have a great following and are very well received in the press, and is of a style that I think is very popular and is, you know, certainly a one that many, many people like. But it's not so much a style that we're looking for. So, you know, people like Charvin and Philippe Brave at Domaine Ferrand, those are more of the style that, you know, the terroir, the spice, the finesse are things that I look for even in big wines.
Because you actually make Grenache yourself now in the Rhone. You got involved with a project down there. How did that come about, and how did you decide to approach the winemaking of those wines?
Well, let me be real clear about that. I don't make the wine. I don't pretend that I can make wine. No, it's with Baptiste Grandjean, who is the owner of Domaine de Christia. And he approached me a couple of years ago about this idea of acquiring this couple of parcels. And together, and he would do the, you know, all the vineyard work and the vinification, but it would be something that would be just ours, and it would be done sort of along the ideas or the I guess the philosophy, if you will, that I would like to try to do as an experiment. So he was amenable with that, and so we got started, and the first vintage was 2009. It's two parcels. One of them is in the Lyre de Gigas, and the other one is at the top of the Lyre de called Pignon. And the vines in the Pignon adjoin the edge of the parcels of Grenache of Chateau Reyes in their Chateau Neuf-du-Pape Reyes. So both parcels are sand. The one that adjoins the vineyards of Reyes is a very light sand. There's practically no Galet Roulé to speak of in either parcel. And it's at one of the highest elevations in Chateau Neuf. Has the exposition is north, slightly east facing. And it's protected because it's not at the very top of the colline of Pignon. The Gigas is then across the road and down about 200 meters to the north, almost due north and a little east, also sand. You know, again, practically no Galet Roulé. Sand is a little different color, a little more gold tinge to it, if you will. And what I thought would be interesting, would be fun, would be to try to do an experiment with terroir that kind of mirrored the philosophy of Burgundy, so that you would have similar soils. It was just really a question of altitude and exposition that was the defining characteristic between the two. And, I'm very happy because also the other factors came together so well. Both parcels were pure Grenache. The age of the vines was very similar, about 50. Some of them in the Gigas, there's some 100-year-old vines. And so we did the vinification exactly the same, a traditional vinification with whole cluster, all the stems. And élevage was in old demi-muy, not old, but you know, 4 or 5 years old. So it was essentially neutral. And so everything was exactly the same. The only difference is the soil and the exposition. And it's been really a lot of fun because, you know, some people prefer one, some people prefer the other, but everybody agrees they're very different. And kind of proves the point that, one grower once told me in Chateau Neuf-du-Pape, you know, the growers who have been around a long time, they know which are the best parcels in every Lyre de, and they trade to get the best parcels. And I thought to myself, yeah, you know, every parcel speaks. And it'd be fun just to isolate a couple, you know, not sand versus Galet Roulé, clay limestone, but sand. And it's been fine. Been fun.
One of the things that struck me when I first tasted those wines is that the label seemed analogous to the old Truchot labels.
That's exactly right. I asked Liliana and Jackie if it'd be okay with them because I was going to do this kind of experiment, you know, in homage to Burgundy. And it is similar, yeah.
In the intervening time between picking up Truchot as your first producer and starting involvement of your own, in 2009 with some wine, you picked up well over 100 producers that you import, many from France, but also from other countries, like Austria comes to mind, a little bit of Italy. How did you end up moving into Austria, for instance?
Well, Austria, that was in 2003. My younger brother is with the State Department and a diplomat. And he was, at that time, in Vienna. He was the chef d'affaires of the embassy in Vienna. So he was essentially in charge of the embassy, serving directly under the ambassador Ambassador Brown. And, you know, when your brother's there in a nice place in Vienna, you go visit him. And so I thought it'd be a good opportunity to also visit some vineyards in Austria and think about doing some importing because, you know, it was something that we didn't have in our portfolio. And, of course, I really admired the wines of Austria, and it was something I was thinking about doing anyway. So I used my brother's place as sort of a stepping off point to go visit growers and, you know, did some reading and Falstaff and other Austrian periodicals and started put together a portfolio. Just started it that year.
Because one of the producers that you picked up was FX Pichler. How did that relationship develop?
Well, that was really very, very fortuitous. I called a number of growers that weren't represented, but I also called growers that were represented and just wanted to visit them to taste their wines, just as a reference for what they were doing with the 2002s compared to with what the people that I was visiting as prospecting were doing with the 2002s. And one of them that was that answered my phone call and said I could come see them was a Pichler family. And so I did, and it was shortly after that that they said that they would like to sell some wine to us.
What are they like, the Pichler family?
Well, it's a wonderful family. Lucas Pichler they have two children. Well, it's FX Pichler and his wife Rudolfina, and they had two children, or have two children, Lucas and Elizabeth. And that first visit in 2003, I met both Lucas and FX. And at that time, already Lucas was doing pretty much the winemaking. I think he began doing it in 1999. And honestly, I think FX has always been happier in the vines. He loves, you know, like all these guys, like Vatton and Truchot and Chardin. First and foremost, a grape grower. he's very quiet, but, you know, like all great winemakers, very proud and very confident because, you know, he works harder than anybody else. So, you know, maybe what he does is probably just as good as anything anybody else does as well. Lucas is more outgoing. And just a very, very nice guy, you know, just very pleasant to be around, modest, easygoing, cheerful, gracious. Elizabeth also, she married Eric Kreutzler. And so that's another domain that we've brought on naturally because it's called Pichler Kreutzler because of Elizabeth. And that's sometimes in Europe, the wife's name comes first, much like Zint Umbrecht, because in that situation, Madame Zint had all the vineyards, and so her name was first. In this case, too, some of the vineyards came from, I don't know exactly which vineyards they own, which vineyards they rent, but they put Elizabeth's name first as well.
When I hear about the Pichler family, I'm often told that they are meticulous record keepers. Is that something that you've seen as well?
Yeah, I think on their website there might be a picture of it. There's a there's like a catalog or a log or what we might call a spreadsheet dating back to 1929 that FX's grandfather kept of every vine. What he did to each vine every year, pruning, you know, deshooting. Date of harvest, yield, incredible. Every vine. So they know their vines.
And another producer that you represent in Novakow is Herzberger. I wonder what they're like as people and as winemakers.
Well, they're similar to Pichler's in the sense that they're both perfectionists. And Franz Sr. and Franz Jr., like FX and Lucas, are very committed to obtaining perfect physiological ripeness in their grapes. But they are at the opposite ends of the Wachau, and they have two completely different microclimates that they're working with. And so it's fascinating from both a commercial but also an intellectual point of view to notice the differences between their two styles. The eastern end of the Wachau, Leuben, Unterleuben and Oberleuben, where the Pieklers are, is the beginning of the Wachau, just to the west of Krems. And there the Danube is somewhat open and facing the east. And you get the winds from the Pannonian Plain, from Hungary, coming to the west, and it's a warm microclimate. And then there's a sharp bend in the Danube, and then the sharp bend back, and then there are hills that come to block those winds. And at the opposite end, by Spitz, you have a completely different microclimate, even though it's only 9 miles upstream or upriver. You have much more influence of the Waldviertel, which is sort of like the end, the bottom of the Bohemian Mountains in Czech. And that is a very cool microclimate. It's the steep wall of the Wachau, you know, then leads up to this complete forest. And so Spitz is a cooler climate. So within that, each one is seeking perfect maturity, but they have differing degrees of acidity, different terroir, and of course, certainly different temperatures and different climate. And each one of them, fortunately for us, for all of us, understands the uniqueness of their terroir, and are seeking to express that the best they can. So with Pieklers, there's a richness and a complexity and a depth, not at the expense of freshness or balance, but it's their style, and they express that in all of their wines. A little longer élevage in wood, but so does Hirzberger. You know, they age in wood as well, but it's for a shorter time, and their goal in their winemaking is the precision of flavors, the crystalline sort of nature of the Riesling and the Gruner from the cooler microclimate of Spitz.
Sometimes with Hirzberger, I have the sensation that they're using Botrytis as a tool to express what they're looking for.
Well, both Pieckler and Hirzberger, I think there's a little. I think there's probably less and less all the time. I think that's partially... Well, I think it's entirely, not just partially, the view of the younger people, Lucas on the one hand and Franz, the younger, on the other, that they're more comfortable in this style of more purity. I think also it's a statement about the times. I think FX and Franz Senior were more going towards a style of exotic and ripe. And I think too there's an evolution, not only in the younger generation winemakers. Approach and palate, but also I think in the wine world. I think we see with our feedback that we have from top sommeliers and people who know a lot about tasting wine, that there's a real trend in the United States towards wines of more purity, you know, clarity, expressiveness, and not just whites, but more and more for reds as well. Now, that's not in all parts of the U.S., but it's growing all around, particularly amongst sommeliers.
speaking of precision and purity, you recently added a producer in a Kremstal that I thought really exemplified that. I wonder how that came about.
Eigner?
Yes, sir.
Well, that was just luck. Because actually, come to think about it, all of these have just been luck. but I was reading about them in Falstaff, and they weren't rated that high as a producer. But I looked at the scores of the wines, and they were very well scored. So it was like the rating wasn't keeping up with the scores. And so I went to visit them, and I could really tell that Wolfgang was a very serious guy, and his son is he's working now at Brundlemeyer, and I'm sure getting a lot of great ideas there. So it just struck me as a really good future. Prices were very reasonable, very fair, but I love the wines. The old vines, Grüneweltliner from Zandgruber is just an amazing balance of richness, complexity, and yet brightness.
Tasting the wines for the first time recently, I was knocked out by them. I thought they were excellent.
I'll be sure to tell them.
Back to other areas of the world for a second. At one point, you brought in some Australian wine.
Yeah, that was in the late 80s, and it was at the time when it was just all the attention was being turned to Australian wines. I was actually being rejected by many retailers because I didn't have any wines that were expensive enough. They needed more expensive wines. It's particularly Australian wines, expensive Australian wines. And you know, I should say that I have always tried to find wines that I love, but at the same time, I didn't always have the luxury of being able to be independent of the market as much as some of the people that I admire and you know, and colleagues that of other importers. Who had sort of the financial freedom to do just what they wanted to do. So at that time, I did, you know, it was a more of a commercial thing to do Australian wines.
But you got out of that.
Even though it wasn't my palate. In fact, I tried to find Australian wines that were kind of like more terroir and more precise, and those didn't get very good scores, so I couldn't keep them on my portfolio. Couldn't sell them.
Besides Austria, where have you found fertile ground in Europe, perhaps more in France or in other areas where you have moved the portfolio in more recent years?
Well, I think one of the really rewarding experiences that I have was to have met the family, the Perez family at Mas Martinet. You know, we import Domaine Gobi from the Roussillon. We represent them, which is a great honor, and they make fabulous wines. And Sarah is, you know, as many growers in France, but Sarah in the Priorat is a real kind of disciple of Gobi. And she makes these just brilliant examples of Priorat for me, just you know, sort of like the Gobi of the Priorat, if you will. You know, very terroir expressive, completely, you know, biodynamic, and you know, not over extracted, no, not over oaked, and just every wine is a complete joy to taste. And I wish I had every producer in my portfolio was like Sarah Perez. Those are great wines. And so that's one I'd love to do, you know, do more things like that in Spain. In Germany, you know, we do Heimann Löwenstein. And those are great wines. They're kind of like the Pekler, if you will, of the Mosel.
He was one of the first to sort of leave the Prodigate levels behind.
Yeah. He clearly is his own man. Makes his own style. And brilliant wines. I mean, just They get to be kind of expensive at the upper end, but they're certainly worth it. But even at the entry level, the Schiefer Terrassen and the Von Blaum Schiefer are just brilliant examples of, you know, completely ripe, beautiful Riesling on slate.
What do you think convinced him that he didn't want to do Cabernet Spätlese Alsace anymore and instead wanted to focus as QBA?
My own, I haven't really, honestly, you know, pinned him down on that, but I think it had a lot to do with his, you know, where he is in the Mosel. The vineyards are extremely steep of Inningen, but it's at the eastern end and it's the warmest part of the Mosel. And I think it lends itself very, very, very well. You know, it's, if I could make the analogy, you know, he's on the eastern end of the Mosel and Pichler is on the eastern end of the Wachau, the warmer ends.
You started in 85. How has the wine importing scene changed in the interim?
Well, there are a lot more importers. and there are, you know, distributors now are direct importing. You know, in the beginning, there were the best, the most famous importers like Kermit Lynch and Robert Chatterton and Vineyard Brands, Robert Haas. And distributors pretty much represented those portfolios. In the last years, their, you know, distributors have gone direct and they're finding their own products, their own producers for their market, for the state in which they're distributing, or for regional distribution, which makes it more difficult to find growers who want to work with an importer. There are basically two ways of looking at the United States market if you're a producer. You know, one is to go direct with distributors in 10 different states or 15 different states or 20 different, whatever, and be dealing with a lot of distributors and you know, fulfill your sales needs that way. The other is to have a sole importer or practically one, maybe two, and to sort of turn the marketing over to them and to work with their network of distributors. And that was what we did. We realized back in 1990 after our wines, 1991, after our wines started getting scored, that we had to develop a network of distributors, because if we didn't, what was going to happen is importers and distributors from other parts of the country would read the scores of our wines and then go to the producer and say, I'll buy them direct from you. So that's why we became a national importer and developed a national network, even though it's on a much smaller scale than the more famous ones like, you know, Vineyard Brands and Kermit Lynch, Neil Rosenthal.
We see importers with 100 plus producers in a portfolio. Now, obviously, that spans multiple countries often, but is there a limit to how many really tremendous producers are out there today, or has everyone got enough room to work in?
Well, I think one of the things that's most exciting about the wine business is that, you know, it changes every day. Every day, a new generation will come at some domain. You know, the son, the daughter, our property will be sold. And it's constantly changing. Like Sarah Perez taking over from her father. Laurent Charvin taking, you know, those were just examples for us. And one of the things about being an importer is you can't help yourself. You're just always looking for that next one that was like the Laurent Charvin discovery, you know, because it is a lot of fun to find someone like that, a brilliant young mind, a hardworking, passionate young person who wants to do something that, you know, his father didn't do, or acquire a vineyard. You know, a lot of growers in the South, like Jean-Louis Triboulet in our portfolio, he's from the Jura, but he went to the Roussillon to acquire the vineyards because, you know, they were easy to, they were cheap, easy to buy. And his wife was Italian and she didn't want to live in the Jura. and he's made some great wines. So it's just, it's that finding, you know, that's exciting. You know, I would say that honestly, I was young and naive and just kind of crazy when I started this 26 years ago. But now I'm older and naive and crazy. That's about the only difference. I'm just as kind of, you know, carried away as I was, you know, when I started. I mean, tasting exciting wine is an experience that just connects for a large number of people. You know, maybe not everyone. A lot of people, it just doesn't mean anything to them. But if it does, you know, to a person, there's nothing just quite like it. That tasting that really exciting wine, and that's what keeps me going. And I, you know, coming into contact with people in the business, you know, for whom it means the same thing, is a lot of fun. You know, distributors, retailers, of course, sommelier are the most fun to talk with. It's a great experience. And, you know, connecting the talented young winemaker with people who really appreciate it, and consumers. Some of the best tasters I know are people who are not in the trade, like I wasn't when I got started.
Peter Weigand, he's found more than a few tremendous producers, and he's still looking. Thank you very much for being here today.
Thank you very much. It's been my pleasure.
Peter Weigand of Weigand Selections.
I'm Molly from Public Restaurant, and I use 750 all the time. It has all of the information I could possibly need. It makes my life so much easier, and it's one of the best reference tools I have. I love 750.com.
And that's this week's episode of I'll Drink to That. You can find the show on iTunes, on Stitcher, and on our own dedicated website, alldrinktothatpod.com. No apostrophe. Thanks for listening.